Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, September 11th, 2025, and our friend Alex Greiner is back with us. Welcome back, Alex.
Thank you for having me again, Nima. Good to join you always.
Please subscribe and hit the like button to help us reaching more people. Alex, yesterday something so shocking happened in the United States. And we've learned that Charlie Kirk shot dead, and he was talking at the university campus. A lot of people there discussing and talking about many issues, social issues, political issues. And what has happened in the aftermath of what is this catastrophe was everybody was taking benefit from what has happened. And some were Israelis, those people who were supporting Israel said he was supporting Israel, he was killed. Right, left, and what's your take? What's your understanding of this? Do we have right and left anymore? Is there anything there to separate people by? I don't see that. I don't see right and left. I don't see that in Europe. I don't see that in this country that I live in Brazil. I don't see that in the United States. I think it's so simple-minded to talk to somehow judge people based on right and left. It's much deeper than that. What's your take on that?
Well, I've thought for a very long time that left and right was a false dichotomy for a very long time because, you know, I grew up in the communist world. In former Yugoslavia, under the one party communist government, and in school we had to study Marxism. And, you know, then I went to the West when I was 17, and you know, the rest of my education was very much capitalistic kind, and I studied economics in university, and then, you know, I became an oil trader, and then I became a hedge fund manager. So I'm not partial to these ideological divides, but I also, the more you understand the actual issues at hand, the more you realize that they're completely false. You know, people in the West think that they live in the capitalistic world, that places like Venezuela, like China, like former Soviet Union, you know, Eastern countries, that they were socialist system. Actually, the systems were exactly the same. They were based on exactly the same monetary system. The differences were mainly about the division of, let's say, the nature of government spending. So in the systems that we call socialists, government spends bottom-up, meaning the money is distributed to welfare programs, let's say more generous pensions plans, more generous healthcare, education, and things like this. Whereas in what we call capitalistic system, the government spending goes top down, meaning it's going to big corporations, primarily to the big banks, military industrial complex, big ag, big pharma, and so forth. They're all very, very heavily subsidized by the government, and nobody complains about it because if the money goes already to the wealthy, let's call it corporate types and bondholders, then everybody thinks that's fantastic. That's, you know, that's how things should be. But basically, that is the difference. And I think that the whole left-right divide is just an ideological construct to keep people distracted by arguing the wrong issues. And so I've noticed now that a lot of people reacted to the killing of Charlie Kirk as though this is leftist violence. It has nothing to do with leftist anything. The conflict, it always, you know, this is very important to keep in mind, and you and I have discussed this more than once. The conflict is between two systems of governance. And those two systems of governance are the oligarchic Western colonialist approach, which is always directed at building an empire of colonies around the world. And then the other side is pretty much the rest of humanity, both, you know, countries like Russia, China, Iran, Brazil, South Africa, and so forth, but also the domestic populations, because, you know, if the domestic populations are not not friendly to this oligarchic system of government, which is prevalent, particularly in Western Europe, in the old colonialist nations like France and Britain primarily, but then also Holland, Germany, and some others, then this system cracks down on their own populations as well, which, you know, we see everywhere around. You know, we've just had very violent clashes between French protesters and French police, which is a regular recurrence. We saw the same in France. The AfD party, which is not friendly to the globalist system, they just had 14 of their candidates in one region die suddenly in the space of 2 weeks, which is, you know, statistically almost impossible. We've had in France the opposition of Assemblée Nationale, led by Marine Le Pen. Basically, she was forbidden by French courts from participating in presidential elections. We had assassination attempt against Robert Fico. We had disqualification of Calin Georgescu in Romania, and so on and so on. And what do all these people have in common? They are interested in their nation's sovereignty. They want to regain their nation's sovereignty. And in that, they are in opposition to the globalist system of these Western European oligarchies, which are also present, by the way, in other places like Japan, the United States, and so on. You know, they have their satellites all over the place. Wall Street is one of the most powerful satellites of this oligarchic system, which is always, by the way, based rooted in the money-lending oligarchies. It's not just any old kind of oligarchies. It's particularly the moneylenders, the banking cartel, the too big to fail banks, people who control them. This is not, you know, this is hidden. So, you know, sometimes people will say, like, well, why don't you name names? Well, I don't know what the names are, because these names are kept hidden, and not even U.S. Congress can get those names to know who exactly they're dealing with. But we know that, you know, certain families turn up all the time, like the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, the Mellons, Fairchilds, and so on and so forth. So we know a little bit about it, but it's all vague and foggy. But this is the opposition, you know. It's the oligarchies of the Western European and powers and the United States opposed to everybody else, not just other nations like Russia and China, but also anybody who opposes them, even domestically. And so I think that Charlie Kirk was an important opinion leader, an important activist and influencer in the United States, who was supporting Trump, whose activism was again in the direction of returning the United States to its Republican roots, protecting the American sovereignty, not selling it out to the globalists. And so he ended up getting killed. There's nothing to do with him being to the right of center and then getting killed by those who are to the left of center. It has everything to do with him being, implicitly opposed to the globalist system of governance. And then, you know, who exactly killed him, we don't know, but allegedly he was himself worried about the Israelis killing him, even though for a very long time he was a staunch defender and supporter of Israel, even into this genocide. But then also he was on the assassination list in Ukraine, I think Birotvorets or something like that. He was on their list. And, you know, from commentary that I see online, a lot of people are saying, no, this was absolutely not a disgruntled leftist. This was a professional, well-planned, well-coordinated hit job. And so I wouldn't waste energy blaming the leftists. It's a different problem that we're facing.
Here is part of what he said on podcast PBD podcast, Patrick Ben David podcast about Israel, Alex.
The whole country's a fortress. When I first heard this story, I still had the same gut instinct that I did initially. I find this very hard to believe. I've been to that Gaza border. You cannot go 10 feet without running into a 19-year-old with an AR-15 or an automatic machine gun that is an IDF soldier, right? The whole country is surveilled. And so let me just kind of go through this. We don't talk about Israeli politics very often, and most Americans don't know this. The last 9 months, Israel was on the brink of civil war. It's not an exaggeration. This judicial stuff, there were hundreds of thousands of Israelis taking to the streets because Bibi Netanyahu was basically redefining the Israeli constitution. That's not an exaggeration, right? He said the judicial branch has too much power. There were protests planned this week against Netanyahu where they anticipated tens of thousands of people to take to the streets. That's all gone, Patrick. Netanyahu now has an emergency government and a mandate to lead. I'm not willing to say, to go so far that saying that Netanyahu knew or there was intelligence here. But I think some questions need to be asked. Was there a stand down order? Whew. Was there a stand down order? 6 hours? I don't believe it. Israel's the size of New Jersey. When I took a helicopter ride from Jerusalem to the Gaza border, it's 45 minutes.
Wow.
6 hours. They're live streaming the killing of Jews. Did somebody in the government say stand down? That is a legitimate non-conspiracy question. The whole country is the IDF. The whole country is.
Yeah.
And you're trying to tell me that they're going to concerts and kibbutzes and schools and by report.
Yeah. These are the same sort of arguments that you've been doing here on this podcast, Alex. It's not that much different from us and what we're talking about. And
yes, exactly. Only Charlie Kirk had a much, much wider following. He was an American. He was close to, you know, his Turning Point USA was very close to Donald Trump. I think that they galvanized a lot of American public opinion towards supporting Donald Trump. So maybe he, at least in the United States, he was a much more consequential player. And then, you know, he started as a staunch supporter of Israel, which means that he probably got very good reception, very good acceptance by pro-Israeli cohort in the United States. So to see him turn and start doubting could lead a lot of these Israeli supporters to turn and start doubting as well. So in that, you know, because you and I are maybe on the same side for a long time. I mean, I thought this was a false flag operation from day one, because I know a little bit about that Gaza border. I have a friend who used to be part of the IDF, their intelligence, and who worked exactly on the Gaza border. And this person told me, 100%, this was a false flag attack. There is no chance that this could possibly happen. I was there. I worked on this border. Not a chance. And then, you know, if you paid attention, there have been, I found another 7 testimonials by former IDF soldiers, commanders, who were familiar with that border and who said the same thing. There's not a chance in hell that this was not a false flag, that there was a stand down. And I think that in the meantime, even somebody somebody came out to say, to confirm, no, we had a stand down order. And so that's clear. But, you know, Charlie Kirk is a different class of person. You know, he was a true believer who started to lose faith. And so a lot of true believers pay attention to him. So if he starts to lose faith, then they start wondering, let's think about this. And then, you know, the broad-based support for Israel in the United States could start to crumble. So who knows? You know, I don't know. The Ukrainians had him on their hit list as well. But then, you know, it's once you understand this perspective that it's a conflict between the, you know, the rules-based global order, this oligarchic system of governance, and everybody else, then you understand that the conflict in Ukraine and the conflict in Israel are two battlegrounds of the same war. And so it's not a surprise that the government in Kiev and the government in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, would be equally irritated by Charlie Kirk and want him dead.
Alex, just coming back, because as we talk about Charlie Kirk, there is a lot of people discussing what's going on and this right and left mindset. Today in Europe, let's assume that when it comes to Macron, Starmer, Merz, can we say who are these people? They're left, they're right. There is nothing there. Why should we go after these sort of arguments, discussions that we do? We know that we are wasting our time.
Well, yeah, you see, I just mentioned the governments in Kiev and in Jerusalem, and they're not leftists, they're fascists. And then if you look at the governments in Berlin, in Paris, in London, they also are fascists. You have in Berlin, you have Friedrich Merz, who is the former CEO of BlackRock Germany, right? And then you have in Paris, in the Elysee Palace, you have Emmanuel Macron, who is a former Rothschild banker. And then in Britain, you have Keir Starmer, who is not a former banker, but he is a lawyer. And then he's the minion of Tony Blair. Tony Blair is the great eminence, the eminence grease behind Starmer government, and the man who actually pulls the strings. And Tony Blair is a fixture of the City of London, which is, you know, the global banking cartel headquarters, right? And then, you know, after he did his premiership, after he retired from being the Prime Minister of Great Britain, he got a £5 million a year job at JP Morgan as an advisor. I don't know what he advised them for, but he did deliver them the war in Iraq with his, sexed up dossier about Saddam Hussein being able to nuke London in 45 minutes. You know, that was Tony Blair. And I think that he was the leader, you know, he was tasked with delivering that war. George Bush and his government, they appear to have been in charge, but I'm not convinced. Tony Blair was very, very deeply involved, and they had very close tie. You know, the special relationship. You don't know exactly how it works, but we know that they have extremely close ties, or they did have until Trump came on the scene. With all the governments, with George W. Bush, Obama, Clinton, and Biden.
Alex, we had Israel attacking Qatar, and this was somehow game-changing for the Middle East, for the geopolitics of the Middle East, but what's going on there. And it's not Syria, it's not Bashar Assad, it's not Lebanon, Hezbollah, it's not Yemen. one of the most important allies of the United States in the Middle East. And they attacked, they failed to assassinate the leaders of Hamas. And here is what Netanyahu said. And we had the Israeli ambassador to the United States suggesting that they're going to continue with this assassination mission. But here is what Netanyahu said.
They should applaud Israel for standing and up to these same principles and carrying them out. And I say to Qatar and all nations who harbor terrorists, you either expel them or you bring them to justice. Because if you don't, we will.
Yeah. It seems that they're not backing down. They're going to attack again and again until they can assassinate these people. What is, when it comes to attacking Qatar and I think the gravity of what has happened is huge for the region. You're taking that. How can we understand that? How do you see the consequences of this sort of act for the United States, in my opinion, primarily?
Well, you know, first of all, thank you very much for having me listen to Benjamin Netanyahu. He always ambush me with something like that. But, you know, the man's hypocrisy is just absolutely off the charts, because Benjamin Netanyahu is the godfather of Hamas. He has, in fact, coordinated with Qatar for the funding, and he has pressured Qatar to continue funding Hamas, even when the Qataris were actually had cold feet and didn't want to continue funding Hamas. So now he's there fulminating against Qataris for harboring terrorists. That's exactly the organization that you brought to life, Mr. Netanyahu, and you insisted on continuing to fund them. For what reason? To preempt the formation of the Palestinian state. So he wanted to fund a group that they wanted to turn into, you know, jihadi fanatics, or they predicated them as such. You know, they wanted such a group in order to say, well, you know, there's nobody to negotiate with, and then to make sure that the Hamas and Fatah in the West Bank didn't talk to each other, that they were on hostile terms to each other. But, you know, regarding Qatar, one thing that is, for I don't know what reason exactly, is consistently overlooked in the Western mainstream media, is that Qatar is a very close friend and ally to the British foreign policy establishment and the British government. Qatar has two air bases that it uses in Britain, where Qatari aircraft pilots are trained by the RAF pilots. I think that Qatar is pretty much the only country in the world that has two military bases available to them in England. Okay, in Britain, sorry. And they are very close. They very closely cooperate in terms of sharing intelligence. And Qatar has been, you know, the home base for this part of Hamas leadership that didn't really live in Gaza. They lived in Doha, in a lap of luxury. People like Khaled Messal, Ismail Haniyeh, and the like, you know, they traveled around on private jets, spent time in five-star resorts. They didn't share the lot of the Palestinian people in Gaza. And when the attack happened on Tuesday in Qatar, my initial gut feeling was that this was an attack on Trump. And, you know, my first question is, who benefits from this? And it's not Trump. You know, as much as people like to hate Trump, this was potentially a fatal blow to Trump's credibility, because this was not the first time he fell into this trap. In July, Trump administration was negotiating with the Iranians, and then the Israelis attacked Iranian negotiators and killed a bunch of them. So this was the second time he fell into the exact same trap. Anyway, you know, as I was wondering about that, then came out the news that there was a British Royal Air Force surveillance aircraft that was circling Doha for hours at the time when the attacks happened. And then we also saw that Trump was very embarrassed. He was saying, "I'm not very happy about this." And then he called the Qataris, and you know, he made a statement about what he said. Maybe that is what he said to them, but basically the gist of it was that this will never happen again, and that they will sign a new military cooperation agreement with Qatar. And then almost immediately after that, Netanyahu comes out and he says, "No, we will do this again." So they exactly contradict Trump in this sense and challenge him, undermining his credibility. So there's that's a huge problem. But for some reason, you know, the role of the British is never scrutinized. It always ends up passing under the radar, and you know, all the commentary and all the vitriol ends up directed at the Americans, and now, you know, particularly Trump. I think we need to look a lot closer at what the Brits are doing. It was their surveillance plane that was flying over Doha, in the very same way that British Royal Air Force surveillance plane fly over Gaza almost every day. And we know that they share intelligence with the IDF in real time. Presumably, they're providing them targeting intelligence so that the Israelis know where to drop the bombs. And so, to my mind, that could be exactly the same reason why the Royal Air Force plane was flying over Doha on Tuesday. So, you know, people unloaded on Trump. In part, he deserved this because he didn't play this very well. But I think that the British role has to be scrutinized a lot more closely.
I think that was we can say that they attack, and it was in the news that they left the room, the negotiations room, were praying, and they went to pray, and that's why they left behind their cell phones that Israeli attacked them. But in my opinion, that was a huge intelligence work in Qatar, and who's behind that? It's the biggest question. There's some rumors that the Turkish intelligence was somehow managed to inform them before it happened. But it was the final minute, the final moments of the attack. That's why they couldn't manage all of this evacuation from the scene.
Yeah, correct. Apparently, it was the Turkish MIT who informed the Hamas delegation or the Qataris that the attack was coming at the last moment, so they were able to avoid it and survive. I don't understand why Trump and his people tried to own this and to say that, oh yeah, we, you know, well, it was Netanyahu who said that the Americans gave a green light to the attack. And then Trump said, like, well, we informed Qatari ahead of the time. But as it turned out, they informed the Qataris 10 minutes after the attack had already happened, which means that they didn't know either. You know, they were taken by surprise, meaning they got ambushed by, I presume, by the Israelis and the British. And it potentially destroys Trump's credibility, because who will now negotiate anything with the Americans, with his administration? You're putting your life at risk if you negotiate with them. And even if Trump is not doing it, even if it's not Trump or Hegseth or Marco Rubio or Witkoff, but maybe their administration is so infiltrated by spies and informants that they can't even negotiate anything with anybody without the Brits or the Israelis knowing about it, then that's a massive problem for them to address. But we'll see what happens, because I think that the Qataris will have no alternative, no option but to try to patch up with the Americans. I think that maybe they will have to rethink their relationship with the British, because if I know that the British aircraft was overflying Doha at the time of the attacks, then they know it. The Russians know it. The Americans know it now. The Hamas people know it. I think that the silver lining in the event is that it has shed some light at who is the peace arsonist in the region. And that the top of the list to my mind is always the British foreign policy establishment. I want to make sure to underscore that it's the British government, not the British people, because as people become more and more aware of the British role, we have to understand that also the British people are being kept in the dark about this and lied to and propagandized, because the conflict between the two systems of governance is not just against foreign nations, but it's also against your own population. And now we see social uprisings kind of gather momentum in the UK as people start realizing what is being done to them as well.
Alex, here is what the Qatari Prime Minister said.
Explanation, because the act itself, the significance of this act, there is no human mind can just absorb it. We were thinking that we are dealing with civilized people. That's the way we are dealing with others. And the action that he took, it's very, I can't describe it, but it's a barbaric action. This prime minister is leading us to a chaotic world.
Yeah. The Arab leaders, I think they're so desperate, they don't know what to do, because all the time they were seeking their security through the ties and the relationship with the United States. If Israel can attack them and nobody's there to defend them, then who's going to be there? They don't have an army capable of reacting or responding to Israel. So yesterday I've heard that Qatari Prime Minister or the officials in Qatar said to Witkoff that they're seeking alternatives to the security of the United States. They may seek in China or Russia, I don't know, other places.
No, obviously, because I think that this is now the culminating moment maybe it's an inflection point, not the culminating moment of the transition from the British model of security or insecurity on the Eurasian landmass, which has always been shaped in the function of divide and rule. So you always pit neighbor against neighbor, and you arm them both, and you give them loan to the both, and you always make sure that when one is a bit more powerful than the other, you support the other to. It's called the balance of power approach, right? And this has resulted in over a century of war on the Eurasian continent. And what the Russians and the Chinese are trying to do is they want to reset this security architecture, so to have a century of peace or you know, permanent peace on the continent. And Israel was created on the in the Levant, in Palestinian territories, exactly for the purpose of keeping the region constantly destabilized, constantly on the verge of war or at war. Just in the last 72 hours, Israel attacked six of the countries in the region. Six in 72 hours. Nobody bats an eyelid. You know, a few drones fly from Russia or from Ukraine over into Polish airspace, and people's heads explode. This is like an unforgivable affront. The barbaric Russians, look what they're doing. Israel bombs six of its neighbors in 3 days, and everybody thinks that that's just normal because, you know, Israel has the right to defend itself and they can do whatever they want. They can kill other people's negotiating teams, their governments, their prime minister and the whole cabinet. In Yemen, they can bomb Iran's embassy. In Syria, they can do whatever they want and nobody cares. And so, you know, an impartial analysis of these things already in 2012 in the United States, in cooperation of all 16 at the time, all 16 intelligence agencies of the United States came to the conclusion that the existence of Israel is antithetical to U.S. interests in that region. And so now this is becoming obvious, you know, and you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of myth, there's a lot of entrenched thinking where everybody thinks that, you know, the United States is subservient to Israel. That's not the case. That Donald Trump is somehow devoted to Benjamin Netanyahu and that he will do whatever Benjamin Netanyahu says. I don't think that's the truth either. But I think that we're coming to the point where things as they are now are unsustainable, and it's becoming obvious even to the public in the West, in the United States, and in the Western Europe, and it's becoming very, very obvious to all the regional powers. And so now, given that the United States can't really act against Israel, because, you know, as we saw, the U.S. Congress is practically owned by Israel. If Benjamin Netanyahu comes to the American Congress today, after 3 years of genocide, and gives a speech, all the congressmen and women, like clapping seals, will give him 50 standing ovations. And half the offices, who knows, maybe more, of congressmen in U.S. Capitol, they have. Israeli flags there and plagues saying, you know, we stand with Israel, we support Israel, et cetera, et cetera. So you can't, you know, politically you can't challenge Israel head on, but I think that the realignment is already taking place. And, you know, we just had, you know, days ago we had SCO summit in Shanghai, in China. And the world is realizing that this is the security architecture that they have today is a way for them to be permanently at war, to be targeted at any time of day and night by the Israelis and, you know, their Western supporters. And so they have to, you know, A, they have to make nice with their own people in their countries, and B, they have to talk to the Chinese and the Russians and to the Iranians, because Iran is now the new cornerstone of the future security architecture for that region.
Alex, based on what you've said, it seems that the United States is trapped in two of the most important British projects, one in Ukraine and the other one in Israel. And I would argue, even with the case of Iran, they're talking about hostages in 1979, 1980, it doesn't make sense anymore to talk about it because of what's going on. The roots of the problems between Iran and the United States is that I think it's come from some sort of hatred they have toward Iran as well. These people that you've described, they're behind the scene. They don't like Iran because Iranian oil was in their hand. They had it all. And
yes. Yes, correct. And the Americans came into the game much, much later. They came into the game after World War II. The British have penetrated Iran already at the beginning of last century. So in the very early 1900s, the British already went to Iran and wanted to secure Iranian oil reserves for the exploitation. And so it was the British who had practically control over all of Iran's oil production. And, you know, then at some point they were losing control there. And somehow, which is a huge mystery to me, they managed to get the Russians, the Soviets, during Stalin's government, to help pacify Iran for them. And so practically 1 month after the beginning of the Operation Barbarossa, which was July 1941, in August 1941, so a month later, the Russians sent about 100,000 troops into Iran to occupy the north of Iran, while the British controlled the south of Iran. But in the end, you know, the Russians ended up withdrawing and leaving leaving Iran over to the British, and then, you know, they established the British Iranian Oil Corporation, and they practically took Iranian oil for free. I think they left less than 9% of royalties to Iran. Almost all the value of Iranian oil was flowing to the British, you know, the company that is today BP. So that was Anglo-Iranian Oil or something like that. And it was only after World War II that the Americans kind of elbowed their way in there. And then they've been sharing it. And they also, you know, when Mossadegh came to power, he wanted to nationalize Iranian oil for the benefit of the Iranian people. And it was not done in any thuggish way. They went through the United Nations. They proposed to the British to compensate them to pay for the facilities and the refineries that they would take over a fair price, but the British were refusing. They were absolutely refusing, and then they drew in the Americans and the CIA, and in cooperation they overthrew Mossadegh and then installed the Shah and his brutal repression regime. So this goes way, way, way back. And, you know, the Americans came into the game relatively late, but the British have been present since I think it was something like 1903, for a very, very long time. And so they've been stirring that pot almost constantly without interruption. And so to this day, it's the British who want the regime change. Because that's the important thing to understand with the Iranian thing is that the objective of this oligarchic system of power in the West is regime change in Iran. They don't care about Iran's nuclear program. They will give Iran nuclear bombs if they get to install their own guy in Tehran in the government. That's the name of the game. And, you know, we saw that Trump isn't on board with that. He said, I'm not interested in a regime change. He wants to make deals for American companies to go in there and do business with the Iranians. But the Israelis, who are the creation of the British Empire and the city of London and Paris, they want a regime change.
Donald Trump, and let's assume, let's say the United States has to decide about what do they want to be, because with the attack on Qatar, everything's out, and Russia and China, in my opinion, they have the upper hand in the region. They can make new friendship, new security, you know, contracts with the countries in the Middle East, in the West Asia, especially. So do you feel that these people who are running the show in the United States would somehow understand the gravity of what has happened? And because I don't see anything good happening to the United States in future, even in the next 5 years, if this attitude on the part of the Israeli government continues, if they start attacking Qatar again, if they attack Saudi Arabia, UAE, Bahrain, these countries, they cannot defend themselves, to be honest.
Yeah.
And Bashar Assad was much more capable of defending Syria than these people in these Arab states.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Nima. And, you know, we don't ever have to go far, but one of the countries that just signed on to the Belt and Road Initiative is Nepal. And 2 years ago, in I think it was November 2023, the champions of color revolutions of the world, Victoria Nuland and Samantha Power, were in Nepal to preach the wonderful wonders of liberal democracy and to pressure Nepalese government to choose between, you know, the rules-based global order and China. And so, you know, the Nepalese chose wrong. They signed on to the Belt and Road Initiative. And lo and behold, today they have a violent color revolution happening in Nepal. And I think if you're the Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, if you're a Qatari sheikh, if you're leader of the UAE or any of these governments, you have to ask yourself, this is coming for me. And so you have to make a choice. Do I want to be a subservient vassal to this rules-based global order, or do I stand up and say no mas, you know, this is it, we're not doing this anymore? I think that Qatar's experience has been a very rude wake-up call, because, you know, until now they thought like, okay, you know, so they want us to help overthrow Bashar al-Assad. Well, yeah, okay, you know, a couple of billion for HTS, Al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, yeah, we'll cooperate with that, you know, we just want to be at peace. We have their military base here. We can't do much. So, but, you know, I think it's very interesting that Trump has now proposed a military cooperation agreement with Qatar, which is something that the British have, but apparently the Americans don't have. And so now you see that Trump is coming into the British domain. He's elbowing them out of Qatar, if I'm interpreting this correctly. And that'll have its consequences, particularly if Trump survives. And then if J.D. Vance takes over or somebody from the Trump camp, then, you know, the British are going to start to get squeezed out of the region. And, you know, I understand that a lot of people think I'm giving Trump too much credit, that he's playing some kind of a 5D chess. And I do sometimes doubt that maybe I am, and maybe they really are as dumb as they appear. But, you know, I also look to the for clues to the British and to the Europeans in general and to the Russians. And so that kind of confirms to me that maybe my hunch is right, because the Europeans are absolutely hysterical against Trump. They hate him. And, you know, it's in their media every day, all the time. And then the Russians, quite to the contrary, they are supportive. You know, the Russians do their homework. They know what they're dealing with. They're dealing with it every day. And so, you know, Vladimir Putin said that when he was at the Eastern Economic Summit in Vladivostok, he said that during the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit in China, that he informed his partners there about the Alaska summit in August, and that the news were very, very well received. And he said that nobody uttered a word of criticism against Donald Trump. And then we had Kirill Dmitriev, who posted two very interesting things in the last few days. And one of them was, he circulated two images. One was like an animated cartoon of three animals sitting around the table and sharing tea as friends. And so one was the tiger with Indian flag above him. One was the bear with the Russian flag above him. And one was the panda with the Chinese flag. So the implication was a friendship between Russia, China, and India. And then below that image, he had the same, only there was also an eagle in the picture with a US flag above him. And he posted this on his Instagram, where he has mostly Russian followers. And the picture says, which picture is better? You know, his post says, which picture is better? The one that includes the United States or the one without the United States? And he posted on X that 77% of his Russian followers chose the picture including the United States. And then there was also, remember Trump a couple of days ago, no, not a couple of days ago, at the end of August, I think 30th of August, Trump posted a picture of himself like this with his hand, and above his left hand he had Q plus, Q, you know, the QAnon. And then above him it said, nobody can stop what's coming. And then below it said, the world will soon understand. So Kirill Dmitriev reposted this picture. And he also, I don't know if it was the same post or a different post, but he said, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin will prevent the outbreak of World War III. He didn't say should, could, might. He said will. And, you know, just so people understand, Kirill Dmitriev is not just a random Russian. He's a head of the Russian, he's head of the Russian sovereign wealth fund. He's the key advisor to Vladimir Putin on questions of economic development. And he was one of the people who was in Alaska to meet for the meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. And so, you know, taking the clues from the Russians, who probably understand this situation a lot better than you and I do, and most of the people in the public, the fact remains that they are very much open to cooperation with the United States, that they prefer that the United States be part of the emerging picture of a new world and new security architecture in the world. And the fact that Kirill Dmitriev said that Trump and Putin will prevent the outbreak of World War II, I think, I don't know, but I tend to think that that's a very important statement, and that it wasn't made randomly, that it was made very deliberately. That tells me that they understand the issues that we're facing. They understand the source of danger and the risk. They understand that World War III is a real possibility and a real risk, and that they understand where the danger is coming from, and that they have agreed to cooperate to prevent this from happening. So, you know, I could be wrong, but I really genuinely hope that I'm right.
Alex, the war in Ukraine has transformed the Russian army. Look at the Russian army today and what it was before the conflict in Ukraine started. It's not even comparable. Let's assume this proxy war put them in a better position politically, geopolitically, militarily, everything, each and every aspect. Why does Russia need to go over Poland? And they're trying to, I talked with yesterday with Alistair Crook, with Scott Ritter, everybody in the alternative media, they believe that it was a false flag operation. Seems one of those last moves before everything's coming down, because if you're not capable to continue the conflict in Ukraine, the manpower, the weapons not going the way that they were going to Ukraine before. So what else do you have? You need a false flag operation. You need a new sort of attitude. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly, Nima. This is, you know, and this is something that many of us have been anticipating and predicting, that in some way it'll become necessary to stage a false flag attack somewhere in Europe in order to, you know, galvanize the unity of the Western Bloc, of the collective West, the coalition of the willing, if you like, to all rise up, come together, and go to war against Russia, because that's the only hope they have left. And, you know, the same thing happened in Syria in, I think, 2015, when Bashar al-Assad was finally on the verge of winning the let's call it civil war, although it wasn't. And then suddenly he decided to stage a chemical attack against his own people, which was very obviously staged with the involvement of the White Helmets and the Western media. And again, the objective was to try to rally the West to come to the aid of al-Nusra and al-Qaeda, and to finish off Bashar al-Assad's regime. But remember, it didn't work. So at least for another 8 years, Bashar al-Assad survived and remained president of Syria. And so today we have this attack, supposed attack. These were all drones with no payloads, with no explosives to them. So it's very strange what happened. The Russians immediately said that this has nothing to do with them, which we don't know. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. There's a possibility that the drones were Russians, but that they lost course because of the EMF warfare, the electronic warfare, that they lost connection with their targeting control. They were apparently all decoys, because they had no payload, and they were all made out of styrofoam. So they were not the geranium drones, the ones that fly in and bomb places. And so it would be so incredibly dumb and moronic for the Russians to stage this kind of attack and provocation deliberately. So almost certainly it was either an accident or a false flag attack. And now you see the European powers all, you know, well, not the European powers, but the leaders of this pro-globalist system of governance, right? All exploding in outrage, the Russian affront crossing into Polish airspace. This cannot be forgiven. We must all come together and go to war, because there you go. Russians have now shown us that they want to invade Europe. This was the beginning. We must unite, and so on and so forth. At the same time, Israel can bomb 6 countries in 72 hours. Nobody bats an eyelid, but everybody is completely outraged about Russian decoy drones. Maybe they're not even Russian. Maybe they're Ukrainian. That dropped into Polish airspace. So I think that we're dealing with a false flag in order to escalate the war, to come to the rescue of Ukraine by uniting the Europe's coalition of the willing, 26 nations that allegedly committed to coming to Ukraine's aid. But I'm not convinced, and I don't know that this is going to work. I'd still like to remind your viewers that since last September, so it's going to be about a year now, all the webcams, well, with one or two exceptions, but several hundred webcams in the city of London went dark. They all went dark, and they're dark to this day. And I think that it's quite possible that this is suggesting that a false flag attack is being prepared for London. So, you know, if you had a nuclear device go off above London, or a dirty bomb, then that could be that, because it has to be a high casualty event, which the one in Poland was not. And it has to be emotionally very powerful. It has to have a very, very powerful emotional impact, because then you follow with the media coverage and you prepare for what Matthias Desmet called mass formation psychosis. And then you can manipulate the population and try to engineer consent for war against Russia. So that's, you know, that might be the big false flag event that they will consider. And I think that they are desperate enough to detonate a dirty bomb in London. You know, it's existential for them. And we already have a statement from a number of people like Gordon Brown, like Mark Milley, like Mateusz Morawiecki. They all are saying, if we lose in Ukraine, like with Boris Johnson as well, if we lose in Ukraine, it will mean the end of Western hegemony for generations to come. So they are that desperate, and they will sacrifice a large number of people in London to create that highly emotional false flag events, to try to create the mass formation psychosis, to trigger a reaction that would then make people in Europe willing to send their sons to die in a war against Russia. Obviously, not for their benefit, but for the benefit of this oligarchy that is running the show still to a large extent, and that wants to dismember Russia, and that wants to colonize Russia, and that wants to turn Russian natural resource wealth into their own private collateral.
I think the threat of having a world war is still there, Alex, because outcome in the case of this false flag operation, in my opinion, in Poland, the response was somehow amazing, that you see F-35, you see Rafale fighter jets, French fighter jets, capable of carrying nuclear bombs going over the Black Sea. These are huge escalations. They can ignite a new, you know, it's something big and bigger than what we've seen so far, a world war. But after all, backing down from this sort of, from what's going on in Ukraine, it seems to me the war in Ukraine, what has happened with the Russian army, what we've seen with the Chinese army, how big, how capable they are, what has happened between Iran and Israel, 12 days of war, which was, by the way, the main objective was the regime change in Iran. It seems that we are somehow moving toward color revolution again, toward some sort of Cold War, a new shape of Cold War. And it's not just in the Middle East. You look at Pakistan, still in the West Asia. You look at Bangladesh. You mentioned Nepal. In Nepal, they're trying to manage a coup, a color revolution, which had those steps of both India and China, which are so much important in this campaign of pressure, putting pressure on Russia. You know, everything's there. And do you feel that the establishment, those people who are responsible for what's going on with these, we can call them globalists. I don't like these names, but yeah, they're globalists. But how do you see, or do they really understand, or have they somehow have they decided that war is not going to work for us. Let's go after color revolution, because they're not that much capable of managing and going against us. Russia doesn't know that much about color revolution. China doesn't know. Iran is somehow, they don't have a clue about color revolution because they didn't do anything in that sort in any region around the world. But they're masters of color revolutions. That's what, that would be their point. Their the most important point for them, because they're so powerful in that.
Yeah, they are good at that, and they have a long tradition of staging color revolutions and coups. But I think that this doesn't have always predictable outcomes, because, you know, sometimes they stage a coup. Well, for example, you know, in Iran, they did stage a coup against Shah Reza Pahlavi, and they brought Khomeini from Paris, but Khomeini turned against them. So it wasn't, you know, it didn't have predictable outcomes. And then they had, you know, they changed the government in Pakistan. They toppled
Imran
Hussein. When was this? 2023. But now the government of Pakistan is not exactly an ally. They have a huge problem with Pakistan. Their regime changed Bangladesh. We'll see what comes of that. So I think that the color revolutions themselves are, you know, you can take down the government that irritates you, but it's not a guarantee that the next government is going to be exactly obedient to you. And even, you know, they helped the color revolution in Ukraine in 2004, but it didn't work because they put Viktor Yushchenko in power, who was extreme. He was about as popular in Ukraine as Keir Starmer is in Britain today. So I think that's not a winning proposition, that you have to keep staging color revolutions and coups, hoping that you'll bring somebody like Zelensky or, you know, somebody like Boris Yeltsin or Juan Guaido in Venezuela. You know, I think that the outcomes of those color revolutions are much less predictable than maybe an outright invasion, a war. And then, you know, we have to remember that the function of war is not just to go and attack your target regime. The one of the main functions of war is for the ruling establishment in your country to have an external enemy in order to keep the cohesiveness of society intact. Because if people are afraid of war, if people are afraid of some evil external enemy that might, you know, send missiles or try to conquer their country or invade, then they will support their governments, even if they hate them. They will close ranks behind them out of fear of the external enemy. So, you know, you don't get that dimension out of a regime change operation, but you do get it out of a war. But, you know, the problem with this escalation against Russia now is that it's all fluff. It's all public relations stunts. You know, they can fly Rafale jets over the Black Sea and pretend to be tough, but they can't get anything done with it, because, you know, without the American satellite intelligence, without the American logistics support, ammunitions, parts, coordination, European war-making ability is very, very limited. And they know that they can't successfully sustain a war against Russia. They can fly their jets and they can blow up a few things, but they will lose a lot of their jets, and they'll come back with their tails tucked between their legs. And Trump is clearly not on board. Trump has just recently announced that they will cut funding to, you know, defense funding, defense spending, to the countries bordering Russia, to the NATO member nations bordering Russia, meaning the Baltic states, Poland, Czech Republic, Hungary, Romania, and Moldova. Well, Moldova is not in NATO, but that's, we're talking about $300 million. So, you know, this again wasn't, didn't get a lot of traction in the media, but it is a real measure. It is a real decision and an indication of a policy turn by the Trump administration, which is another reason why the Europeans are super extra panicked. And not only are they escalating this war, but we also had Ursula von der Leyen this week speaking to the European Parliament and saying that we are at the verge of a new health emergency, you know, another pandemic. What on earth is she talking about? It looks like they're grasping at straws. They will try to do anything now because they are literally facing defeat in Ukraine.
What Trump administration is trying to do is putting a lot of pressure on them. And with the case of India and Turkey, Donald Trump is saying to Europeans that not only you're receiving directly oil and gas from Russia, but also you're receiving from India and Turkey. That's why the main, after all, after more than 3 years of the war, we are approaching 4 years of the war, Europe is receiving the most Russian oil, Russian energy.
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, that's not going to go away. That's just the reality of how things are. You know, I was in Croatian military during the war in the 1990s. And I remember that we traded with the Serbs a lot. You know, we were fighting the war against the Serbs, but when they needed oil, Croatian refineries delivered oil to them and sold it to them. And we even had, now a friend of mine told me the story where he was positioned, and he said they were in the middle of, you know, there were Serbian position, Croatian positions, and Muslim positions. And so there was the fighting erupted between the Serbs and Muslims, and Croats were just there, but they were not engaged in this fighting. And so one day the Serbs called the Croats and they said, well, we ran out of mortar shells. Do you have any? And the Croatian command told them, yeah, we have them, but we're not going to give it to you because then you're going to shoot at us. And then the Serbian commander said, no, we need them to shell the Muslims. You have our word, we won't shell you. And so the Croats said, like, well, okay, then. So they sold them a shipment of these mortar shells, and then they shelled the Muslims, and they kept their word. They didn't shell the Croatians. But, you know, things like this happen in war. You know, that's the reality of how things are. So, you know, the fact that, you know, the Europeans are so desperate to destroy Russia, but they're still buying oil and gas and who knows what else from Russia, that doesn't surprise me. You know, maybe they have to tear off the labels and have the Indians buy it and then import it, you know, indirectly, even if they pay higher premium. But these kinds of things are going to happen all the time. You know, war is not hermetic, and it's not all-encompassing. You know, certain commercial arrangements still function as though nothing is happening. I think that's just normal how things are.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Alex, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Pleasure. Thank you. Until the next time, Nima.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
Take care.